Morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, I'll start off by saying a little bit about Buddha and Jesus. Actually, I look back and I gave a few talks a few years ago, a couple of talks in the Sermon on the Mount, but I'm only going to talk about Jesus for this much. Buddha and Jesus were both radicals. They both did not follow the established way. They both lived a life counter to the dominant cultures of the time. Jesus in Israel, Buddha the Hindus in India. Now somehow Buddha was a little more shrewd because he didn't get himself but they had a very similar intention. Jesus himself talked about the peace that passes understanding, that can't be understood with the mind, that passes it, not because it's far out, way far away, but because it's right here, because the kingdom of heaven is within, right? Sounds like Buddha, don't you think? Sounds like Buddha. Bodhi, awake, just awake to this, to this stillness, right in the middle of the hurly-burly of our minds, of our lives. So, one could say that all countercultures have some similar components. They're individualistic, they're anti-authoritarian, and they have a belief in the possibility of personal and social transformation. And spiritual countercultures in particular generally say there's a timeless silence that we can tap into through our practice and through letting go of all of our beliefs and all of our plans and all of our worries. And that we can tap into that and manifest it socially, manifest it with each other, right? with each other, with the world. So in Judaism, we have the Hasidic counterculture. In Muslimism, we have the what? The Sufi counterculture. And in early China, and then coming to form Zen, we had the Taoist counterculture. The Taoist counterculture coming together with Buddhism in China and forming Zen. So two streams formed Zen in China, those two streams. And this Zen counterculture, which is referred to as the golden age of Chinese Zen from about 600 to 900 when it was vibrant, it had four components that it got from Taoism. One, iconoclasm. Whatever cherished beliefs we have. What's your most cherished belief? Whatever institution we depend on. Do you depend on this institution? Whatever established value, practice, ritual that you have, take it lightly. Take it lightly. Or do what the Taoists did with the Confucians. Thumb your nose at it. You don't have to flip the bird at it. You can just thumb your nose at it. Because if you flip the bird at it, you're creating a duality. If you thumb your nose, you could just do it playfully, right? Just playfully. Iconoclasm. Nature as inspiration, as a teacher, as a scripture, the sun, the moon, the sky, the earth. Like Calhoun. Really? Just being by Lake Calhoun. Just being with it. It's a huge, wonderful teaching that can enter right into the center of your being. Right into the center. humor and play. Humor and play. All through the Tang Dynasty. Zen masters. Cutting up all the time. And Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi, my own teachers, cutting up all the time. Humor and play. Humor and play. And number four, spontaneity. Spontaneity. So then we have Buddhism after about the year 900, starting to get a Zen Buddhism. Buddhism's already established in China. It's been established for a long time. But Zen Buddhism becomes established. 10th century, 11th century, 12th century, 13th century. By 13th century, the priests are a separate class. They own land. A monastery's own land. And they're divorced from society. And they have rituals and layers of robes. And everybody kind of walk quietly around them. Sometimes asks to visit the monastery. But they have got big power, right? So the counterculture is mostly evaporated. No, not entirely, but mostly. And many people think that that's why Mao was able to, that Buddhism was so corrupt in China that Mao was very easy for Mao to come in. And with his Marxism, and there are some components of Marxism that are, I won't get into this, but they're very, very Buddhist in it. From each according to his ability, to each according to her need. That's Buddhist. But the Buddhists had forgotten that. They'd forgotten that. And then we have in Japan, our ancestors are Japanese Zen, and Dogen. Dogen, who was not happy with the Buddhist culture in Japan in the 13th century, not happy with it. He saw the Tendai practitioners, Tendai Buddhism, all in their heads, talking about different levels of realization and how you could evoke them and arguing about who had what and how to get to where and who was the best. And you saw the Shingon teachers doing magic, astral traveling, amulets, all kinds of cool shamanic stuff. But he saw how caught they were by that stuff, how caught they were. And how it had become enculturated. And he saw the Amida Buddha people praying to Amida Butsu, the big Buddha in the sky who's going to save them. And he thought, well, what does this have to do? All this stuff have to do with Zen. What does this all have to do with settling down to just the stillness that's right here? So he went to China and found this one counterculture guy who was left, this old cranky guy. You can be cranky and be a counterculture guy or a woman. And then he came back trying to ingest some freshness into practice, into Zen practice. So we all agree that the source of deepest wisdom is right here, our own practice, our own discovery and manifestation of a stillness that is always here. It's always here. Institutions, beliefs, rules for behavior, ritual, secondary. Good. We need to express, but not primary. Because if they are, we get caught. So the focus in all of Zen and in Buddhism in general is the real focus is how do we get enlightened? How do we get enlightened? And some people in Soto Zen, it's not good to talk about enlightenment. You're not supposed to talk about it for some reason. I don't know why. But in Rinzai Zen, they're always talking about enlightenment. Who's had a Kenjo experience? Who's done this? Who's done that? But because you're not supposed to talk about it, I'm going to talk about it, right? Of course. Why not? So, three dimensions of enlightenment. three dimensions. Gradual. The support of a teacher. The support of the teaching. Something you've read. Something that you repeat to yourself. Something that you pin on your refrigerator. The teaching that helps you. And the support of the community. 1, 2, 20, 30, 100 people. And any techniques are okay. Use some techniques. Buddhism is full of techniques. But don't get so revved up by the techniques. The techniques are helping you do your, what I call, turtle practice. Just take one step. And then just take another step. Pretty soon you're down by the lake. Pretty soon you're across the lake because you've just taken one step. Just take another step. You're not in any hurry. There's no hurry. Gradual enlightenment, we say. Gradual. Kadagiri used to say, when you walk in the mist, at some point you notice that your clothes are wet. Or someone notices it for you. You don't notice. You think, oh, God, this is so hard. I'm not making any progress. But you keep doing it. You keep doing it. And at some point, your clothes are wet. And people benefit from the dampness of the sweetness of the nectar that comes out of your wet being, your wet clothes. It's true. So gradual enlightenment. Not getting carried away by outcome, but focusing on just doing a meditation in a way that will help you still your mind just a little bit. Just a little bit. And then sudden enlightenment. Second dimension. Sudden enlightenment. Well, enlightenment happens outside of time. So it's always sudden. It's not having to do with time, right? It's sudden. Time is something we create. So Kadagiri's book, Each Moment is the Universe. That's sudden enlightenment. Each moment is the universe. Each moment is the universe. Radical immediacy. Right now. No mediator. When the mediator stops mediating, then sudden enlightenment. Right now. Not later after you've practiced in 32 sesshins. Now. It can only happen now. Well, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do the 32 sesshins. Everybody should do at least 32. 32 is a sacred number. It's part of the Buddhist culture. So letting go of an attempt to mediate, an attempt to approach stillness, because that attempt blocks our spontaneous feeling of wonderful joy at just being here with each other, just being here with each other wherever we are. So we say Bodhisvaha, the end of the Heart Sutra. Awake, wonderful. Awake, wonderful. Nothing to do with time. Doesn't happen in time. It's timeless. It enjoys time. It appreciates time. Time is cool. And the third dimension of enlightenment is Dogen's dimension. Enlightening each delusion. Delusion after delusion. I've been practicing for 50 some years. Delusion after delusion. Can I enlighten it? Can I just be there with it? Just in stillness? Just, oh, shit, there it is. I mean, it doesn't mean I won't be profane. There it is. Oh, can I take care of it? Can I enlighten it? I can just shed a light on it without judging it. Without doing anything about it. Just being here with it. So, I talk about this in my book, and I want to read something. About a friend of mine from my book, Nothing Holy About It. This is my friend Alice, enlightening her delusion. Without any warning at all, Alice's ordinary world ended when she suffered a psychotic break. She was hospitalized. Then she got the diagnosis, schizophrenia. Nobody wants to get that diagnosis. Nobody wants it. That's the worst diagnosis. I mean, that culture. Our culture says that's the worst diagnosis. Right? That's what our culture says. Alice's ordinary world ended when she suffered a psychotic break. She was hospitalized, then she got the diagnosis, schizophrenia. She felt it meant a lifetime of disability, sense-dulling medication, and stigma. She said, "I've had bad dreams all my life, but I never thought I would have this bad a dream." Alice struggled and bemoaned her dream. She wanted out of it, but there was no out. It was her dream, and all she could do was engage it. After about a year, Alice was able to fully accept and even embrace her situation. She learned to stay on her meds. She completed the mindfulness-based stress reduction program developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn, which uses meditative techniques from both Zen and Vipassana. Because it's taught in a hospital milieu, Alice was in a safe environment, surrounded by others living with a grave diagnosis. She was taught to stay in her body and to be with the pain she was experiencing, to open up to it and to breathe into it. Dogen says, "Without expressing dreams, there are no Buddhas." Alice steeped herself in meditation, and after a while she found peace. It was somewhat limited, but she made up for the limitations by the depth of perception. She went back to college and finished her degree. She's now very happy, fully expressing her dream as a professional counselor for others who have mental illness. So she recognized and she released. She recognized and she released. She recognized and she released in a very difficult situation. If she could do that in a situation of such extremity, you guys can do this. It ain't that hard. It ain't that hard. Recognize and release. The tyranny of shoulds runs our lives. And it's hard to become present to what's real for us in this moment because of the tyranny, because of the inner critic and shoulds are so mean. Mean. But as the inner critics and the shoulds recede, we can enlighten delusion after delusion. Delusion after delusion. And be helpful to other people that way. Be helpful to ourselves that way. Just like Alice did. So we need to be careful also that our enlightening activity, whether it be Zazen, Zen meditation, or if we're Sufis, Sufi dancing, or if we're Catholics, going to morning mass. My grandmother went to morning mass every morning for years. We want to make sure those don't give way to dead habit. So that's just the possibility they will get dead, and then we have more shoulds, and they get more dead, and we have more shoulds, and more dead. So that's should culture. But be careful of should culture. And notice when it's like that. Notice when it's like that, and don't allow yourself to be plagued by should culture. A little should is good, but way too much with your inner critic. Way too much. Just 10% of what you do. Most of you. Now, a few of you are narcissists, and you should do more. Donald, this talk is not for Donald Trump. But most people who come to Zen practice are not narcissists. I mean, why would they be? Most of them are not. So, one of my favorite, I have a whole bunch of favorite enlightened counterculture figures is Hanshan from the 8th century. Hanshan. And he was iconoclastic. Cold Mountain Hanshan. How many of you know Hanshan or have been exposed to Hanshan? A few of you. He was iconoclastic. He had long, wild hair. He had been a Zen monk, and he had long, wild hair. And he was playful and humorous, and he had a buddy named Shite, who was a monk, still a monk in the monastery. And they would meet right outside the doors of the monastery. And here's what a scholar says. Hanshan with Shite would stroll for hours in the corridors of the monastery, occasionally letting out a cheerful cry or laughing. When taken to task or driven away, he would stand still afterwards, laugh, clap his hands, and then disappear. So that humor. And nature, just being with a light, just being with one tree in the backyard. If you're just with that tree is a wonderful scripture for you. Wonderful scripture. It doesn't know it's being a scripture. That's why it's a good scripture. It's just showing you how to be alive, just how to root yourself in the ground, root yourself in the earth, and rise up to the sky. And let the wind pass through and just be with it. Nature. So Hanshan lived on Cold Mountain. And here's an excerpt of one of his poems. To learn where the wild ducks fly, follow the white hair banner. Find a magic melon in your dreams. Steal a sacred orange from the palace. Far away from your native land, swim with fish in a stream. And 500 years after him, Dogen says, the mountains and waters of the immediate present are the path of the ancient Buddhas. They are the penetrating freedom of things as they are. No need to judge things as they are. Riding the clouds and following the wind liberates us from the mountains. These green mountains are forever walking. So we're not nature mystics. We're not nature mystics. It's not nature's there and we're here. It's all here. It's all here. And spontaneity. So Hanshan was nothing if not spontaneous. Nothing but not if not spontaneous. Which is different than impulsiveness. Impulsiveness. What's impulsiveness about? The thing occurs, it's mapped in my consciousness as emotion and thought, then it hangs around. It plays off other thoughts, other emotions, still hanging around. And then later, it's an echo that clouds the moment, so I can't be here. It's just a cloud. A cloud. And then I act impulsively. That ain't spontaneity. Is not spontaneity. So, I'll pick on George W. Bush for a moment. George W. Bush, so, acted from his gut, right? He acted from his gut. He wasn't into a lot of words and, you know, a lot of reading. He acted from his gut. Well, was he the Zen teacher of old in the White House acting from his gut? I don't think so. I mean, look at the Iraq War. If you study George W. Bush, you know that he had a residue from his dad. That his dad's backing out from the Persian War, refusing to go all the way, or wimping out, and not taking Saddam Hussein down, stuck with him. So as soon as 9/11 occurred, he had an opportunity to act, to go after Saddam Hussein, who had nothing to do with 9/11. Nothing. And he probably didn't even know this. Impulsiveness comes up, and we don't know. We think we're acting from our guts. Well, okay, he's acting from his gut. But what happened? And what's happening 10 years later as a result? Or however many years later? It's 15 years later. My goodness. So that's not the spontaneity that these Zen teachers are encouraging us to tap into through our practice. So spontaneity isn't reactive. It comes out of your stillness, the still mind or the still no mind, and it just bubbles up, And we act wholeheartedly in the world. We just act wholeheartedly. But we have to start with the habit of practice. The habit of practice is important. As T.S. Eliot says, being springs from the depths of which the day knows nothing. Being springs from the depths of which the day knows nothing. Music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all, but you are the music. Comes unexpectedly. Suddenly the music moves into our being. No thought, no judgment, no conscious effort. Suddenly, it's here. So I've told the story many times of being a student, Zen student in San Francisco, and sitting every morning early on a very busy in a Jewish synagogue overlooking a very busy street in San Francisco, where our Zen center was, in this Jewish synagogue. And in the morning, there was a one-way street going downtown. So in the morning, there'd be huge traffic. And just when we get seated, we'd been sitting for 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes, the traffic would start roaring by. And then, of course, in the evening, we had no traffic at all because it was a one-way street. And we sat. But in the morning, struggling with that noise just throwing me off base, making me mad, actually, that noise. The noise of those cars, those trucks, and thinking about the pollution. Why do they have to go so fast? And my mind going fast and da-da-da-da-da. Right? When I say, why do they have to go so fast? What's going fast? What's going fast? And then at some point, I don't exactly know, at some point, I just let the music start passing through. And the music just didn't bother my meditation at all anymore. It just passed through. It was just punctuation of the stillness that's in the meditation hall in the world. Nice to have some punctuation of some sounds and sights. And I was able just to enjoy it. I'm not saying I did it perfectly, although when I think back then, I only remember how wonderful it was. You know, as you get older, you remember. You don't remember. You remember things in a more two-dimensional way. You remember the awful things and the wonderful things, but not the nuance. So how can we live our lives with a quiet joy that's beyond understanding? Not because it's out there, just because it's here. It's just here. Is it possible to stop choosing knowing and judging, and judging over a direct experience? We're always choosing, consciously or unconsciously, knowing and judging, and judging, and judging our judging, on and on, ad infinitum, over direct experience. Zen is about learning to give priority to direct experience, to just whatever it is, just doing it, just being with it, whatever it is, taking care of it. Taking care of it. Well, not with, I should take care of it, but, I feel connected to you, so I want to be there for you. I want to be there for you. So T.S. Eliot says, between the thought and the action falls the shadow. Between thought and the action falls the shadow. But he also says, so the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing. What Zen master did he study with? British Anglican. What, must have been some British Anglican father or something. Or maybe he just did it himself. We have to do this ourselves ultimately. Ultimately, it's us. It's just us. So, culture includes, whatever the culture is, a process of being acculturated, right? Being socialized to judge right and wrong, good and bad. And there's some advantages to that. There's an advantage. We form some strong neural connections that after a while, after we get pretty, we've been around for a while, operate with high efficiency to make judgments. Discriminating thought then operates as our default mode in many, many circumstances. So, I'm preparing for a talk, Discriminating Mind. I've read lots of stuff. I've practiced for years. So Discriminating Mind weaves it all together before I come in here. Weaves it all together. Weaves it together based on my experience with you, noticing what you get alert when I say something and when you go to sleep. And, you know, that's part of my discriminating mind, right? How long I should talk. Although it doesn't, my discriminating mind still goes on much too long sometimes. I mean, my talks still go on. My discriminating mind, it doesn't go on, but my talks go on too long. But that's because I'm not paying attention. We need to pay attention to our discriminating mind, right? Need to pay attention. On the other hand, we construct our identities around the cultural code or morality in which we've been trained, right? And our spiritual practice becomes tethered to that, whether you're a Catholic or a Buddhist or a Taoist or a Native American. So we need to be careful of that stuff. Careful of it. Institutional religion is mostly about being good. Look at it. You challenge me, but look at it. It's mostly being good, trying to be good. And this is exactly what the Taoists and the Golden Age Zen Buddhists and Suzuki and Katagiri pointed out to us, that as long as we're trying to be good, we get judgmental about anything contrary to the image we have about how we and others should be. If you want to get ordained, you should do a certain thing. And of course, you do need to do these things, but can you do them without an overlay of judgment and criticism? And if you fall down, can I support you without an overlay of judgment and criticism? I mean, that's what this is about. That's what this is about. So we have the colored glasses of our culture that we're always wearing. But through meditation, if we're Buddhists, if we're Zen Buddhists, through Zazen, if we're Sufis, through Sufi dancing, if we're Catholics, through going to Mass every morning, but really going there, really putting yourself there. My grandmother was very upset with the first Mayor Daley in Chicago when he beat all those people up in 1968 who came to protest the Democratic Convention. Because she knew he was raised Catholic. I was Catholic like her. And she knew he went to Mass every morning. And she said to me, he didn't live the teaching. What good was it for him to even go to Mass? He didn't live it in his heart. So, through our practice, we can take off these colored glasses. Not be tethered by all this stuff inside. All these judgments. So I want to finish off by doing a guided meditation, and then we can have a little conversation. So get comfortable, and close your eyes, three quarters or all the way, and I'll talk for a little while. Take a few breaths. Just following your breath all the way in and all the way out. All the way in and all the way out. And when you're ready, bring into your mind a time when you judged yourself or someone else harshly. When you're ready, bring into your mind a time when you judge yourself or someone else harshly. Notice what your thoughts were or still are about this. Notice what your thoughts were or still are about this as you stay with it. Just staying with it. Letting all judgments about this come in or go out. Letting them be there. Letting them be there. And you even might want to repeat to yourself as you see the judgments, judging. On the in-breath, you might want to say to yourself, judging. Not trying to get rid of the judgments, just being with them, opening your heart to them. Noticing your in-breath in your nostrils or your tummy. Breathing in to wherever that judgment seems to reside. Breathing in to wherever that judgment seems to reside. And if there's some tightness or there's sense of discomfort, just being with it. Just being with it. And on the out-breath, letting it all go. And if it doesn't want to go, just letting it all be. Noticing the judging. On the in-breath. And on the out-breath. Letting it go or letting it be. And when you're ready, you might want to breathe out a deep, swooshing, relaxing breath and say to yourself, I forgive myself for judging. I can let it go or I can let it be. You might want to breathe out a swooshing breath and forgive yourself for judging. You can let it go or you can let it be. Breathing in and breathing out. And you might want to say to yourself, may I forgive myself? May I forgive myself? May I allow myself to put down the burden of judgment? May I forgive myself? May I allow myself to put down the burden of judgment? I no longer need to carry it. You no longer need to carry it. Sitting in meditation, just another minute or two more, and coming back to the room. In a couple of minutes, I'll ask you to come back to the room and open your eyes. Another minute, and you might be ready to open your eyes and come back, and we'll talk a little. Okay, so those of you who are ready to open your eyes, open your eyes. So I think the most important part of this is self-compassion. Self-compassion. In Buddhism, we're always talking about compassion toward others. But without self-compassion, without being compassionate with your own judgmental mind, with your own shoulds, how they build up and how they congest, you can't really be compassionate to others. So that's why forgiveness, if forgiveness helps you be self-compassionate, forgiveness to yourself. If I forgive myself, then I can forgive Darla. If I don't forgive myself, my forgiveness to Darla is going to be fake. It's going to be just part of an acculturated process, right? A civil process. We want to be civil. That's fine. But I'm talking about something much deeper than that. Much deeper than that. So that's what I have to say for today. And we have about 5 minutes to see if there are questions or discussions. Question or discussion or spontaneous song. Not impulsive song, spontaneous song. Then you think you're judging, oh, is this really spontaneous? I've got to do it spontaneously. Judging, right? Was Tim being impulsive, or is he a great Zen master? Well, I don't know. Sometimes I'm spontaneous, sometimes I'm impulsive, you know? Lightening one delusion after another, right? New delusions coming up at 73. I never thought I'd have, but we won't get into that. You wait. Next year you're going to have some new ones. Happy New Year in January. Happy New Year. Yeah.
Can you say something more, please, about the difference between spontaneity and impulsivity?
Oh. Well, I thought I said a lot. Well, impulsiveness, we're acting out some pain or discomfort from the past with impulsiveness. It's a reaction. It's a reaction. Spontaneity is not a reaction. We're not acting out something that's in our head from the past. We're just enjoying eating the melon in the backyard with Hanshan.
How can you be sure you know the difference?
Pardon?
How can you be sure you know?
Oh, you can't be sure. You can't be sure. Yeah, you can't be sure. But you know, if George Bush had had me as his counselor, I would have said, I would have talked to him about how he, I mean, really, I would have talked to him about how he felt about his dad's failure, what that was like for him. And if he really thought, I would have tried to work with him on this so I could bring to his awareness that this was not some, you know, his wonderful intuition, that this was coming out of his own stuff that he'd inherited and his a bad feeling about how his dad had behaved. So in Zazen, we have a chance to actually see that stuff come up. We see that reactivity come up. And the more we can see that reactivity, which comes from impulsiveness, come up, the more we can be free of it and just be where we are. Be spontaneous. But we never get it down perfectly. And if we start judging how well we're doing, don't do it. Don't judge it. Instead, just practice. Just be. Yeah.
And you said what you do with Bush. What would you do with Cheney?
What would I do with Cheney?
Yeah.
I take him out to the woodshed. my Zen stick. You know, I have a stick. I haven't used it on you yet, Lawrence, but you better watch out.
Also, I liked what you said about, you know, being present in nature.
Uh-huh.
When I do my meditative hike, you know, every month I, you know, we go down to a place and I tell people to, you know, it's not formal meditation, but try to be in the moment, try to be present.
Uh-huh.
And I find, a lot of times I find that that's, for me, it's more focusing, you know,
uh-huh,
as far as being able to be present, rather than even being in meditation all this.
Yes.
In nature.
Yes. Uh-huh. Could you guys hear Larry? Oh, he's just... Larry's just... Do you want to say it again or shall I say it? You have to say it in a big voice.
Yeah, okay. Oh, okay. I was going to say, like, on my meditative hike, we do once a month around the time of the full moon, I tell people to... This is not formal meditation.
Uh-huh.
It is real meditation. It's really meditative in terms of being in the moment, you know, be present. In the moment.
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
I find
yeah.
it's easier for me to be out in nature and be focused and more present than I do in a meditation hall.
Yes, many people find that. Thanks. Many people find it's easier to be present and still in nature than in a meditation hall. But the meditation hall is important too, because if we can't always be in nature. And after a while, when we've been in nature, we actually start behaving badly because it becomes part of our routine, part of our habit. So being in a meditation hall helps us not see that the freedom and the stillness is right here, that it doesn't depend on the tree, that it doesn't depend on the sky, doesn't depend on, it's right here. The sky's here, the tree's here, the lake's here. But nature is important. So both and, both and.
Can I say something?
Sure.
Yeah, with meditation, you can hear it very easy. Everybody's quiet.
Uh-huh.
Being in nature is also very easy. But I think that the real meditation that I guess I am trying to get too, is when I am in real life.
That's right.
People,
right.
Because then
it's
when you realize in my presence.
That's right. So... We only do meditation or be in nature so that we can be in the world with people, so that we can be at Hennepin and Lake in rush hour and feel cool and calm and just enjoy the cars whizzing by us. Whoa, wow, red, blue, yellow. Yes, this is about daily life. Why would we be doing this to learn about daily life? Good, thank you. Thank you. Yes, back in the corner. Oh. Larry, she's had her head up for a while.
One of the marks of spontaneity to me is that often it doesn't make sense.
Spontaneity often doesn't make sense. That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's cool. Beyond common sense. Let go of common sense. Uncommon sense.
I mean, if you wake up one morning and something you treasure comes to mind and you know that you have to give it to somebody.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'm all.
That's wonderful.
Very
joyful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you. Thank you. And someone way back there, it looks like Pamela. Hi, Pamela.
Hi. I am loving meditation, and I am wondering if you could say a little bit more about letting it go or being with it.
Letting what go or being with it?
Our judgment.
Our judgment. Well, yes, we put a lot of emphasis on letting go of our judgment, but sometimes our judgment won't let go of us. So it's good to try to let go, but don't try too hard. Better to let it be. Just let it be. If you try hard to let it go, it's just going to cling to you like the tar baby clung to Br'er Rabbit. So just let it be. When Br'er Rabbit finally let the tar baby be, then tar baby didn't get him anymore. He was still covered with tar, but it didn't get him anymore. How's that, Pamela?
Yeah, that's it. In meditation, you know, a judgment came up for me that was so helpful, and I'm glad that you let it be, because it's something I need to work on, something I need to, you know, look at, and seeing the judgment of it was very illuminating.
Yes, sometimes. So that's a good point. And there's an addendum to that is that sometimes we get thoughts in our meditation that are really helpful to us. We get some sudden inspiration. It's a thought. So we're not trying to get rid of all our thoughts. Thoughts are bad. You'll get some inspiration or you'll put something two and two together. You know, I'll prepare for my talk. And then I'll just come sit, and then at some point, two strands that I hadn't thought about might come together in my sitting. So I just appreciate those. Now, the goal is to just appreciate them, let them be, and not get into a big story about them. And I've told everybody who I've ordained here, when you're sitting in meditation, don't prepare for your talks. I mean, I don't care, because that's the tendency. You have a talk, like I'm going to give a talk at 10 o'clock. Here I am sitting with you guys at 9. I didn't have time to prepare because of A, B, C, and D. You know, there's always an excuse. Or I should prepare better. So, but when we're sitting in meditation, we just try to meditate. When we're cutting carrots, we just try to cut carrots. And without comparing and without shooting ourselves, shame, shame, because during the last 10 minutes I didn't meditate at all, and during the next 10 minutes that when I was in the kitchen I didn't even think about the carrots. I just thought about when I could get out of here and what I was going to do the rest of the day. Shame, shame. Well, then notice the shame, shame. That's your judging. That's your judging. And be kind to it. Self-compassion. Be kind to it. Oh, very important. Lawrence.
Yeah, just another comment about something Rocio said about the being present, being meditative in the action. It reminds me of a class I took from a year or two ago about when you talked about Dogen and different kinds of illumination. Intuitive illumination and actional illumination.
Uh-huh.
Dogen seemed to prefer actional.
That's right.
I like the idea of that myself.
Yes.
Sort of being present and
yes.
Action-based.
Yes. So Larry's talking about the teacher Dogen's teaching. And he prefers actional illumination to just illumination. It's in our activities that in the world, like in Hennepin or at our job or with our spouse who's bugging us, that we can enlighten the delusion that exists between me and her by just being here with her and opening up to her and engaging in authentic dialogue with her.
I think the intuitive illumination is good, too, though. I mean, Dogen seems to almost
prefer actional to it exclusively. So Lawrence says, intuitive illumination is good, too. Dogen seems to prefer actional illumination. Yeah, yeah, intuitive illumination is good, too, and Dogen prefers actional. You're right.
Maybe one of them is training, and the other is implementation. Because we're training here, trying to meditate, trying to meditate.
That's right. We could say that the training in the Zendo helps us be actionally illuminated when we go home and our spouse pisses and moans. Because we're able just to go home and we don't have that burden. Our mind is pretty cleared out, so we can just be there with her and see what her, feel what her distress is. Just feel it. Yes, Benton.
One way that I help let go of judgment, especially on the internet when I'm reading forums, is I remember a cartoon that I read once that had two cartoon figures, and one said, "Dear, are you coming to bed?" And he says, "No, I can't. Someone is wrong on the internet."
That's great.
Which is really telling you there is no end to things you can be judgmental about. So you might as well not even start.
That's right. Very good. Very good. Thank you. Okay, time's up, and now thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Darla now.